So today we've got two speakers, Rob Curtis and Julian Braganza from KPMG. Rob leads KPMG's global, he's KPMG's global regulatory lead for insurance and leads the ASPAC insurance risk and regulatory practice. Rob's been, Rob developed the ICAS regime in the UK and led the FSA Solvency II program. He's currently been following regulatory developments worldwide, and Julian has been assisting him with that. So today they're here to give us those insights and share, I guess, some ideas about what the implications are for us in Australia as to what's happening in the rest of the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Brylan, and good morning, everyone. Pleasure to be here. And Brylan mentioned, this will be a joint presentation with Julian and myself, and we've been looking at all of the global developments in the last year. I should say also that really pleased to see John Moroney in the room. Those who don't know John, John's basically writing the material as we speak. So anything we don't get right this morning, no doubt John will tell us. John and I used to work together, actually, when I was chairing the Solvency Subcommittee of the IIS when I was at the UK FSA. So we go back a bit. And we basically started out this journey, if you like, on the insurance core principles. And that was really the start of the process, which was really getting the IIS as the global standard setter along to these international standards that we now know as ComFrame and what that means. So just in terms of the outline over the next 40-odd minutes, what Julian and I will go through, give you an outline of just where the world is going in terms of the global insurance supervisors, what this actually means, and we'll try and contextualize that for us here in Australia, because often a lot of people look at it sometimes and they think, well, these really won't affect us, will they, because we're already here with a lot of our APRA standards. So we'll try and contextualize what that means for us as a domestic audience and player. Then we'll go through some of the actual mechanics, if you like, the BCR, the basic capital requirement itself, the GC implications, what that looks like, IAIGs, the internationally active insurance group. So there's lots of new acronyms which have sprung up, if you like, over the last sort of 12 to 18 months in terms of the global developments. Another one, the ICS, the insurance capital standard. So you might be thinking, what does all this mean? So hopefully we can explain that more fully for you. Go through some of those more technical aspects that are the components of the ICS. And as I say, we'll finish that with what are the likely implications for Australian firms and what are the key challenges going forward. And we'll finish that off with a timeline. So just to contextualise what this looks like, if we give a little bit of background, the insurance core principles, I don't know how many people are aware the room here, but the ICPs are effectively really what started a lot of the initial work. They are the insurance core principles, which is what the IMF and the World Bank, when they do their financial sector assessment programs, their FSAPs, they go around periodically to different countries and they review, in effect, the compliance, if you like, of those jurisdictions to those international standards. So in insurance, it's the ICPs, and there's something analogous on the banking side, which is the banking core principles, the BCPs. And so when we were doing this, and John and I were on the actual solvency committee, we're doing it, actually what you realised is that when the supervisors got together around the table, quite often they didn't think that their system that they knew very well in their home market was necessarily the same as someone else's. And yet, when we started going through all of the different issues around capital and solvency risk, you actually realise that we're all talking the same sort of language, but just albeit slightly differently. And therefore, we have more commonality amongst ourselves than what we do being dissimilar. So as a result of that, it was, right, we've got to get ourselves on a common page as supervisors, this is when I was in supervisory land, about what that looks like. And so the ICPs are effectively trying to do that across the different measures. In solvency, there's four main solvency ICPs, but there's a whole raft of 22 other ICPs which are quite important, about basically how supervisors should go about their jobs and what infrastructure they should have in play for the supervision of insurance firms. So that's, you know, quite an important construct there. And then as it was going through that process, it was quite clear that actually we needed a better framework in which to undertake group-wide supervision. So there was an emerging thought process in about 2007, 2008, around, you know, wanting to move towards better supervision of conglomerates. And if you looked at the large insurance groups, there was a move to how could we better supervise those large insurance groups, notwithstanding that every country had its own supervisory requirements. And so just before the financial crisis, there was a move to say, actually, let's try and get together and see whether we can have a common framework for how we undertake the supervision of these large internationally active insurance groups. And that's where the term IAIGs came through. So not to be confused with AIG, but this is the internationally active insurance groups. So those large groups who are going across borders, how best to actually manage and supervise those particular groups, given the complexity. So that was something we did, went across to from London, went to Washington, we spoke to the NAIC, we said this is something we should probably think about doing. It hasn't ever been done before in the insurance sector, but we think we probably should do something more constructively in terms of supervising these large groups. And at the time, the NAIC were, that makes a lot of sense. The rationale is quite sound. Let's see what we can do. And from there, actually, the work commenced. Now, what happened 2 months later, the financial crisis happened, and actually, that really gave fuel, if you like, to the FSB, the Financial Stability Board, who said, actually, look, if we look at you as a sector, insurance, you don't have a Basel-type accord, you don't have a global framework, it's all very bespoke, it's all very jurisdictionally based. That's probably not an efficient way going forward in terms of supervising some of these large groups. And so that was, if you like, the crisis gave added impetus to the original idea of actually coming together and making the supervisory colleges work better and more efficiently. So that's what, if you fast forward a few years on from that period, and you say what actually has now transpired, well, John and his team at Basel, at the IAS, have been working quite hard, it has to be said, to, you know, galvanise the global community of supervisors, if you like, because it really, nearly all the supervisors are members of the IIS. They are the global standard setter for the insurance sector. And so the issue was, how do we get a better, more converged set of requirements for these large groups? And so out of that came the basis of the ICS, the Insurance Capital Standard, but it really started with the BCR, which was the originally termed the backstop capital requirement from the FSB. So they said for the largest 9 global systemically important insurers, the GCs, we want you to have a mechanism, IIS, and therefore insurance supervisors, about how you actually supervise these large groups as a minimum backstop. What is your floor, if you like, you might use if you had to, that would actually have some sort of international consistency. So what you have here on this simple graph, if you like, is a BCR, basic capital requirement. The backstop was changed to basic. No one really quite understood what backstop really meant. So the supervisors developed the basic capital requirement. And then sitting above that is the insurance capital standard. And going forward, if you like, you could see the BCR in terms of an 85 or 90% calibrated sort of number. And we'll go through the BCR detail in a little bit to come. Sitting above that's the ICS. It's not clear yet where that figure will actually come out at. But if you look at what Solvency II has with their BBB 99.5, over a one-year time frame. There's nothing magical about Triple B, but it was basically when the insurance supervisors, and APRA was one of them back in the early days in 2000, we basically said, well, if we're going to look at developing a new risk-based capital framework for the non-life sector, then we have to have some sort of calibrated number. What should that look like? OSFI had done something very similar in terms of coming up with a triple B, and that basically equated to an S&P rating. Anything below triple B, you're in junk bond status. So, and if you're a rated firm, you can't get reinsurance cover. So the rationale was really, okay, if we're a supervisor setting minimum regulatory capital requirements, then it probably makes sense to then equate it to something like a triple B. If you're doing it anything below that, you're in junk bond status, and that looks a little bit odd. So that is the sort of issue around where an ICS may be calibrated to, because you'll have that sort of what is the right level of policyholder protection that should be afforded globally, not just within any particular country. So at the moment, you have Solvency II, who's going for 99.5 at their what they call the solvency capital requirement, the SCR. That in IAS terminology equates to a PCR, that's the prescribed capital requirement, or the higher intervention point, if you like, the ladder of intervention of when supervisors would intervene on capital requirements. And then you've got this thing above it sitting up there, which is a HLA, a higher loss absorbency. And the higher loss absorbency really is there for those non-traditional non-insurance activities, again another acronym here, NTNI, activities, which basically the GCs might still have. If you like, it's a capital add-on for those particular risks. If they can't mitigate those down, then the supervisors might apply, if you like, a capital add-on for the potential risk that those NTNI activities may pose on the group. So you've got this sort of layering, if you like, in IAS terminology, BCR, ICS, HLA. And, of course, this is where the issues are really around how best to now not only develop the framework, so what sort of risk-based capital framework do you actually have in that program, but also, more importantly, what is the minimum level of policyholder protection? And does it make sense that the US is about 95% with their RBC regime, the Japanese are probably at a similar level, we think. Then you have countries like Australia who their minimum is already 99.5 and there's an add-on. So Australia is already, if you like, out on the right of that spectrum. And then you have, of course, a lot of other countries who have got simple premium and claims tests who are still down here on the left very much. So you've really got quite a diverse range of policyholder protection levels at the moment in existence. And really what the ICS is going to try and do is get some sort of better convergence of those requirements, hopefully. We did a study at KPMG a few years ago. We said actually this costs the industry anywhere in the region of 15 to 25 billion in aggregate year in, year out by all the supervisors having different bespoke requirements. And that's a lot of money. So who's actually paying for that? It's your ordinary policyholder who's actually incurring those costs. So we said as a result of all of the supervisors having their own capital requirements, their own valuation requirements, their own approaches to risk measurement, et cetera, you create inefficiencies in the system by those firms having to change every time they go between markets those internal processes. So notwithstanding there's a lot of commonality, there's actually still those differences and that costs a fair bit of money. So the idea around moving towards, a better, converged, consistent set of global requirements is absolutely sound, really, and makes good sense. And now the issue for John and his team and the broader, insurance supervisors collectively is how best to get there, how do you move to that framework. Of course, you've got to remember everyone is coming from a certain position. So even here in APRA in Australia, the men and women there quite like their own APRA regime and are quite fond of that. You go to Europe and the Europeans quite like their Solvency II that they've just spent 14 to 15 years developing. And you go to the States and they love their RBC framework. So it's really a matter of politics as much as anything else. It's not really a technical issue per se. A lot of these countries now have existing RBC frameworks in place, so it's not as though people can't actually develop an RBC framework. It's really around the politics of moving people to a single framework and what that might look like. And so that will be the key challenge going forward over the next few years. You can see the 9 GCs who are there now. Whether the reinsurers, for example, come into play later this year, that might be something that a few extra firms get added to that list. This is always subject to change, depending on whether they do or don't have those NTNI activities and what risk that might look like. But suffice to say, you know, this is really now getting to a point where there is serious development on the policy front, developing the different frameworks. And what we'll do now is we'll go through each of those, the VCR and the ICS, and Julian will take us through what that looks like in the next couple of slides. And we'll take questions at the end, but by all means, if anyone has any burning uncertainties as we're going through, do feel free to raise your hand. Tom.
Thanks for that, Rob. So the purpose of this section really is to go a bit more in detail as to what are the proposed methodologies for calculating all the BCR, the ICS, and of course later on they will be flowing through the HLA through the consultation document that's being prepared by the IIS. But this will largely touch on just the BCR and then the ICS. So at the moment where it currently stands, the BCR applies to all globally systemic important insurers. So that is all GCs, and it's anticipated that this will be applied on a group-wide consolidated basis. So really, the BCR is really what it says it is. It's a very basic capital requirement, and what it is, the way it's calculated is through a simplistic factor-based model. So you have basically your starting position is your balance sheet, where you take into account a number of exposures based on the business lines through which the insurance company operates. And against those exposures are basically a number of factors that are calibrated based on the level at which the BCR is targeting. So, which was highlighted earlier, this is around 85 to 90% value at risk. So really, the factors that are being developed by the IAIS are a result of the field testing exercises that were conducted towards the end of last year, and they will evolve as the target level of capital becomes more clear as to where the BCR ends up landing. So Rob actually touched on the purpose of the BCR at the start of the presentation, and what it is looking like is as the ICS develops, as the HLA develops, the role of the BCR will also come into question. And at this stage, it's looking like it'll evolve as a minimum capital requirement as a very basic floor to ensure policyholder protection. And of course, the ICS will cut in at a much higher level, albeit potentially much lower than where LAGIC currently stands at 99.5%. So the BCR was effectively developed towards the end of last year in October, and that was endorsed by the G20 summit in Brisbane. And what we've seen is as a result of field testing, the level of capital that's held by a number of the GCs and the 33 volunteers that participated in the field testing exercises is that it's quite high. So you can see numbers of around 427%, 404% against the required capital coming through from the BCR calculation methodology. And this is largely a result of, again, the level of confidence this is targeting. But also it goes down, if you look more into the detail, the treatment of the qualifying capital resources, what it is really. And what we're seeing is that any margin over the current estimate of liabilities is being treated as qualifying capital resources, which is, again, helping support the level of that particular percentage up there. In terms of the BCR more broadly, in terms of where it's at, as you can see, it's a really simple approach, and it's largely reflecting the level of risk within an organization, and being a factor-based approach applied to exposure data on the balance sheet, you really you really come down to a capital requirement that increases with business size. And it's not as risk sensitive as one might like from a global capital framework. And with that simplistic approach, you can see there are a number of limitations that might arise from this particular capital requirement. And in saying that, for example, it does not consider things like benefits from asset liability management, so where your assets and liabilities move in line and mitigate some of the stresses, or it does not take into account things like group risks or liquidity risks, for example. So I mean, it is ultimately a simple requirement. It is a basic flow, and that's what it's intended to be. So a lot of these additional add-ons are sort of pushed by the side, and it's intended that the ICS will largely cover a lot of these requirements. Okay, so if we move on to the next slide. So this slide over here really summarizes in a nutshell the approach that's being adopted for the BCR. And as outlined earlier, so you really have factors for each of these exposures relating to business lines that are being operated by the insurance company. And those factors will be a result of the targeted level for the BCR. And, of course, then you have the non-insurance business activities with which the insurance company operates. And what the IIS is trying to do is really adopt any existing global framework that is currently in place, whether they be the Basel III leverage ratio or risk-weighted assets that apply to any banking business within which the insurance company operates in. At this stage, non-financial business activities are something that might be pursued further by the IAIS, but at this stage there's no requirement for those activities within the BCR. Okay. So in this section of the presentation, I just want to briefly touch on the IAIGs. These are the internationally active insurance groups. Particularly important because they are the groups that will be at which the ICS will be targeted at the insurance capital standard, and the whole rationale is that the ICS will apply to these groups on a global basis, so it's a group-wide standard, and these groups are particularly important because they're large in size, they have a significant level of international activity, so they're operate in a number of jurisdictions globally. And so it's important that supervisors take a more coordinated approach in the way they supervise these particular insurance groups, whether it be through capital or other mechanisms. So you can see over there that those are the criteria that's typically used to identify these IAIGs. There's currently no list published by the IAIS, but it is anticipated that there would be a number of IAIGs within Australia and globally as well. So look at about 50 IAIGs in total. So the ICS will apply to all of these IAIGs and GCs as well. And, of course, then you have the other ones, the BCR and the HLA, coming into play. So in 2014, last year, the ICS basically published a consultation document on the insurance capital standard, which basically laid out the foundation as to what they're thinking about in terms of how do you calculate the capital requirement, what are the valuation bases you'd use to develop the balance sheet, what would be the qualifying capital resources, and so forth. So that consultation document came out towards the end of last year, and they're basically seeking industry feedback as to what thoughts they might have on the approach that's being proposed. So that's something that the IIS will take on board and will use to refine their methodologies going forward. So in terms of where we're seeing APRA is at, so APRA certainly is actively engaged with a lot of these discussions around the development of the ICS. And what we're seeing increasingly is that the ICS is likely to form a capital, both in terms of the methodology to derive the capital requirement will be quite similar to what we currently have in place through LAGIC, which is what we'll see in the next couple of slides. But there's always the question around the actual target level of capital. Is it going to be 99.5 or is it going to be something lower than that? And if it does end up being a bit lower, then the question, the pressure will be on APRA as to saying, well, why are you so high at 99.5 when the rest of the industry globally is coming in at a level below that? So that's really the drive and the sort of the impetus that we're seeing at this stage. And of course that'll emerge as these developments unfold and sort of galvanize going forward. And the last point there, it sort of remains unclear whether APRA will adopt the ICS going forward. Okay, so if we look at the ICS, the Insurance Capital Standard, a bit more detail, and here I think you'll really start to see the similarities emerging between the current LAGIC framework and what's being proposed. So it's envisaged that the ICS will be implemented as a PCR, so a prescribed capital requirement, and that'll come in at a level somewhere around the high 90s, it's anticipated. And it's also anticipated that it'll be supplemented through a backstop capital requirement, sort of a BCR, which is similar to the basic capital requirement, and that will be sort of an MCR, a minimum capital requirement. And the ICS, through its guiding principles, is really intended to be quite risk sensitive. It's intended to be the actual capital requirement. So as a result of that, it is complicated. It is similar to our LAGIC framework. As you can see there, for example, you have the major risk categories of an insurance business. So you have the insurance risk, market risk, you have credit risk and operational risk, and the associated methodologies with which they're proposing to adopt to estimate the requirement associated with each of those risks. So as you can see, it's quite similar. You have sort of stress testing, factor-based approaches and stochastic-based approaches potentially for catastrophe risk there. And certainly a lot of these stresses and these factors will need to have in mind the target level of confidence that needs to be achieved in order to set those stresses. And of course there's a number of questions open at the moment as to whether those stresses might differ by geographic region, how they may differ by asset class, for example. Different countries have different features that may require different stresses to be applied, and potentially these stresses could be determined by each jurisdiction's supervisor to the extent that the capital is required separately and then aggregated up into the group level. Certainly, as well, there's a lot of discussion within the ICS of what recognition will be given to its diversification benefits that might arise through the ICS. And certainly the number of approaches have been put forward, including assuming no diversification, just aggregating up all the risks, or assuming a correlation matrix that might come through through the mechanism. So certainly there's a lot of discussion around both the actual calculation itself, how do you come up with the capital requirement, what diversification do you allow, but what we're seeing ultimately at the end of the day is that this framework is very similar to what's being currently implemented through LAGIC, and it wouldn't require a lot of effort for Australia to realign into this particular requirement given our a similarity with what's being proposed. Okay. Next slide. Okay, so if we look at coming up with a global capital framework certainly requires an asset and a balance sheet as your starting position. So it requires a consistent valuation of both assets and liabilities on your balance sheet. And certainly what's being proposed by the IAIS is that the assets will be valued largely at fair value. But of course, as many of you may know, is that the liability valuation approach across jurisdictions are varied. And what we're seeing here is that the IAIS is proposing something that's very similar to where Solvency II is heading and where IFRS 4 Phase 2 is heading. So a very similar valuation basis with where global developments are going. And it's largely adopting the building block approach where you have your projected expected future cash flows, allowance for discounting, a risk adjustment, which is the margin of the current estimate to allow for uncertainty in cash flows, and then layered with that the contractual services margin. And certainly what the IAIS is proposing is an adjusted valuation methodology that uses an IAIS prescribed yield curve, and the margin of a current estimate, that's still open to question as to how it will develop and how it will form part of the valuation. Certainly they could adopt an approach similar to Solvency II where they use the cost of capital methodology to come up with the margin, or something along the lines of maybe using stressed assumptions to come up with the additional requirement. And also, given the varying valuation bases that are currently in play globally, what we're seeing is that the IAIS might propose a gap with adjustments methodology. So where, for example, you have a number of US companies adopting US GAAP, Japanese companies adopting Japan GAAP. So you have a number of different valuation bases in play, and the IAIS is trying to simplify the transition of this new valuation basis by coming up with a gap with adjustments approach that will make it easier for these companies that operate on different valuation bases to implement. So it's still unclear where this may end up landing, and that'll form part of the considerations going forward as well. So if we move on to the qualifying capital resources, so this here is really the resources that are used to back up onto the capital requirement proposed by the ICS. And they're largely split up into two tiers, segregated. And it's really quite similar to where Australia currently is as well. And so you have your tier one, which is really your ordinary share capital and your preference shares, and tier two, which is largely your debt securities, which is split up between paid up debt securities and non paid up debt securities. So what we're seeing is that it's quite similar to where LAGIC is at, and although albeit further granulation in the way it's segmented at this stage. There is also there's likely to be some exclusion of intangible assets, such as your DAC asset, and there is likely to be some level of ratios, such as how much each level of capital can contribute towards qualifying, so to ensure that there's sufficient levels of quality of capital within the qualifying capital resources of the company. So if we quickly touch on the high-level timeline, so here what we're seeing is that at the moment we've got the initial consultation on the ICS coming through. So that's been wrapped up, and the industry has provided feedback on a lot of the proposals that have been put through by the IAIS. And the BCR has also been bedded down and endorsed by the G20 at the Brisbane Summit. So going forward, what we'll see is the HLA consultation document coming through. Once that's been bedded down, and the industry will begin to provide feedback on those proposals as they emerge. But more holistically, the timeline for completion is the IIS is targeting 2019 as the be all and end all date for implementation, and but that's likely to go beyond that, given the complexity of this implementation and ensuring that everyone is happy with the approach that's being developed. Okay. pass this on to Rob to talk about the key challenges.
Okay, thanks, Julian. So what you can see is a number of issues which will come to play, mainly because, as I say, the differences in jurisdictional practices now have to be considered. And, you know, if you have the US, for example, they have a different valuation approach in particular. John, I think tomorrow, John, you're actually, or is it this afternoon? Tomorrow, actually presenting on where the good and the great currently are in terms of some of the valuation discussions globally. So that will be quite an interesting presentation, I'm sure, in terms of just seeing where the dialogue is getting to at this juncture in terms of the approach. But there's clearly an area around how do you actually move to a more consistent approach in terms of valuing assets and liabilities, which are consistent between the different markets. A lot of the discussion in the US has said or centered around, you know, until you fix that issue, it's really very difficult to move towards, you know, anything else on this whole, you know, discussion piece around a global standard. In the interim, I think a lot of people are saying, well, we can do that at the same time, a lot of that thinking, and therefore it shouldn't necessarily hold us back. But I'm sure John tomorrow will provide us with a pretty good update as to where those current issues are on the valuation debate. But clearly, we mentioned before, policyholder protection is going to be key to this. I don't think it's one of technical difficulty in terms of why we can or can't get to a global common framework around this. It's not going to be technically that difficult. It's going to be really more of the politics and actually moving, because there are quite a lot of sensitivities out there that everyone has to be cognizant of. As we mentioned, the US are currently somewhat below, say, the European standard, so you're bringing them up. So there's a lot of issues around suddenly imposing additional regulatory capital requirements on US insurers, for example. And you've got the same sort of issue, really, in Japan, who are, as we mentioned, about 95. So they're the sorts of, you know, really technically challenging issues from a political perspective, which is really causing some issues, which we'll just have to have time as well to flow through and have that dialogue. I think a lot in the US are still somewhat afraid of what this means at this point. And of course in the US you've got 56 different states and territories. They all have to actually come together first and have a common view before then they even try and hope to, you know, face off to the rest of the world as it is. So the task is actually quite monumental when you think about it. So the fact that John and his team and others at the IIS are all working feverishly hard at the detail in coming up with this over the course of effectively a few years is really quite an achievement. As Julian said on the timeline, 2019 may stretch out. I think the original target was 2019. It's now a bit more flexible in terms of just recognising some of the difficulties that still might need to be had in terms of the dialogue and going forward. But what does this mean for Australian insurers? What does that look like from our context? The really interesting one is probably, as Julian mentioned, it's going to have a lot of similarities to LAGIC, so it's not as though this is going to be a sudden departure from that. The risk-based framework is going to look very, very similar in many contexts. The IFRS issue, I think, will get most people there, so that will look on a valuation basis very somewhat similar. So it really comes down to, you know, what does APRA actually need to change to accommodate something like this? And if I were a betting man at this point in time in 2015, you'd probably say there wouldn't be that much that is going to require a change, only because of where the technical work is going in the BCR and the ICS is looking very similar to what we already have here, which is a great outcome. The likely change, though, will be around that level of capitalisation, that calibration standard. As I mentioned earlier, APRA is already 99.5 for its minimum, which is certainly well above where others are in terms of a minimum capital requirement, and they then have an add-on above that. So, if you like, that would probably, if you're a good prudential supervisor, you want more capital, not less, and that's effectively where APRA is coming from, saying we don't see why we would necessarily take away some of those requirements from our Australian insurers when we're already at that level. And we've worked quite hard to get to that level. So now we don't really want to necessarily ease back on that. But you have the Europeans, of course, Solvency II. Their highest intervention point is going to be 99.5, and the MCR is somewhat lower. So you've just got these differences in supervisory approaches, which are going to have to, over time, come together, hopefully, and get a greater convergence of ultimate views. So this is where we think there's going to be. Around risk management, we probably think that actually in the wash-up, you are going to get something very similar to what is currently there in the ICPs, more formalised, in terms of everyone's now implementing ORSAs, for example, the own risk and solvency assessments. Here in Australia, we have ICAP. It's effectively analogous to that ORSA framework and requirements. It's very unlikely. Pretty much the rest of the world has signed up to Pillars 2 and 3, if you like. They haven't done a lot of work in Pillar 3 in terms of reporting and disclosure, but there's going to be the eventual aim. I think most people are on that page. Greater disclosure and transparency is a good thing. So that is likely to carry the way. Pillar 2, most people are signed up, as I mentioned, to ORSA and those sort of good risk management requirements, and it's really Pillar 1 and not necessarily the detail, I don't think, which is probably going to be where the challenge is for John and his team and others in the IAS to actually get final agreement. Now, I'm just conscious of time, and that leaves us a few minutes for questions, if there are any. Hopefully there are some, at least, or maybe John might have a comment. If we've got anything wrong here, he can set us straight. This is a fast-moving area too. There is a working group that is looking at these issues right now. There's 33 or 36 firms drawn in that 30-something, yeah, in that working group who are looking at these issues right now as we speak. They're holding meetings, all around the world. Trying to get that stakeholder engagement. So it is actually something which is happening right now, and you're seeing a lot of change in Asia as well, not necessarily as a result of this, but from the ICPs. But all of these discussions that are happening now will certainly influence what those other jurisdictions are going to ultimately implement as part of their ICP regime change, and you're seeing that in Singapore and Hong Kong, for example, right now. So I'll just stop. And are there any questions out there? Yeah. And then Jermaine.
Sorry, could you step up to the mic to ask questions? Thanks.
Just for my own understanding, you've mentioned a few times that the 99.5% calibration is higher than other jurisdictions. Is there any public analysis of that fact? For example, have you gone behind all the assumptions that lead to the calibration? Because unless those assumptions are at least as strong as other jurisdictions, then it's difficult to conclude that the 99.5% VAR is higher than a different jurisdiction's one.
Well, that is what APRA's MCR is calibrated to, at 99.5, and other jurisdictions' minimum capital requirements are less than that. So by the time they go through and do their add-ons, if you like, you end up APRA being higher than most other jurisdictions. In fact, I don't know of any others who are necessarily higher than APRA's at the moment. So that is the issue for APRA as well, in terms of justifying, if you like, why they are at actually that point vis-a-vis other jurisdictions.
I think it's an issue for the industry as well, in the sense that the minimum capital requirement which cuts in is being termination value for a lot of companies. That's actually higher than the 99.5, I think. But when it's been previously explored by, the industry, not APRA, but explored by the industry is, should we remove or loosen that restriction in some way? The actuarial profession is very reluctant to get rid of that and to say, well, actually, in a termination value situation, the company is worth something, even though in every situation that that's happened, people have actually managed to sell the policies or get some value out of it. So although we can say big bad APRA, in fact, it's us as a profession as well that's very nervous about losing some of those minimums. So it'd be interesting to see how we'd actually move to a lower capital level and how we as a profession get comfortable with that.
Hi there, it's Luke Seabury from MetLife. We have the 9 IAIGs. Is your gut feeling that they're going to be asked to bring in more capital, a lot more capital, over, you know, when all of this is implemented? Or are they going to be able to find a way to reduce their capital? Because when it comes down to it, a very theoretical framework, but they're going to, it'll be a number of dollars of capital, and you either have more or less.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. The 9 GCs who are there now, we've actually helped one of the large groups who are not a designated GC as yet, ironically. And the analysis is that they're very much saying, well, there's not really the critical economic functions that the bankers have, for example. So in terms of additional capital or whether there should be even this HLA, the industry's been quite strong, I think it's fair to say, in the last few years about advocating why this regime's even necessarily there and what that would mean. The issue too for the IAS is that the at this stage the framework's going to be at the group-wide level, and there'd still be the solo legal entity requirements in each jurisdiction. So how that interplays is also unclear at this stage, because it's still a work in progress. So a lot of what we presented today is still going to change over the course of the next few years, because they're still in development mode and looking through all these issues. But whether it actually results in absolute additional, you know, higher regulatory capital requirements is really the question which many are wanting an answer on, particularly in the US, because, as you know, it's a different level. But overall, whenever they go through this period, it's usually that the overall level of capitalization doesn't necessarily increase, but it's that degree of surplus assets to regulatory capital which might change. And so that's really one of the issues in play at the moment, is once you get commonality around what that calibrated level ought to be, you know, what impact does that actually have then on different markets? And there will be different overs and unders, if you like, because you've got lots of jurisdictions now which have a lot of hidden capital and prudential margins in existing, you know, prudential requirements, which aren't necessarily on an economic basis. So that's the sort of, you know, challenge that John and his team and others are working through in the next few years to try and look at what that precise impact will be and what that might result in. But there's lots of people who would like not to see a rise in capital requirements, obviously.
And I think we've run out of time now, so thank you, Rob and Gillian, for an excellent presentation.
Thank you all.